Hello there, welcome to this special episode of Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast, with me, Ken MacDonald.
And with me, Tim Owen.
And on this special episode, we wanted to provide a reaction to the passage of the Safety of Rwanda Act, or indeed to give it its full title, the Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Act 2024, which passed its final parliamentary hurdle on the 22nd of April this month, at the conclusion of a process known as ping pong, during which amendments are batted backwards and forwards between the House of Lords and the House of Commons. Rishi Sunak had made it clear that the government weren't going to give way, and they didn't. There were one or two minor concessions, which we can get into later. But I'm delighted that to discuss the passage of this bill, we have with us again Jonathan Jones, King's Counsel, an old friend of the podcast who needs no introduction to our listeners. He was, of course, head of the government legal department between 2014 and 2020. He was appointed an honorary King's Counsel in 2019. Jonathan has, since 2021, been a consultant at the magic circle firm Linklaters, and he's an honorary professor at the Durham Law School, his alma mater. Jonathan, welcome back to Double Jeopardy.
Thank you. Very nice to be back yet again.
Yes. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for joining us again.
I thought we might start, Jonathan, with you giving a brief summary for our listeners of the key provisions of this Act, and then we'll go on to discuss some of the likely next steps, which you have helpfully covered in a note that you provided for the Institute of Government on what may come next in the history of this legislation. But could we just start with a brief description of its key provisions before we get into some of the problems?
The Act is in large part a reaction to litigation in the Supreme Court, which said that Rwanda was not a safe place to send asylum seekers, having the Supreme Court having heard evidence from, amongst others, the UN High Commission on Refugees. So to reverse the effect of that judgment, the government brought forward this Act, and the main thing it does is to declare that Rwanda is safe for the purposes of receiving claimants to asylum and humanitarian protection. So it reverses the Supreme Court judgment. It's backed up by a treaty, which we may come on to talk about, between Rwanda and the UK, as to how such claims and how such claimants are to be treated if they're sent to Rwanda. But the main point is that the Act says that for all relevant purposes, Rwanda is now to be treated as safe. And it goes on to say that every decision maker, that's to say every relevant minister or civil servant, and every court must treat Rwanda as being safe for these purposes.
So just to pause there, what the legislation is doing is it's legislating for facts on the ground, the opposite of those facts which were found by the Supreme Court after a careful analysis of what actually is the position in Rwanda. So this is rather Orwellian situation where the government is saying, we don't care what the evidence before the Supreme Court appear to demonstrate. We say the facts are that Rwanda is safe, and that's a fact enshrined in legislation.
It's a fact, but it's also a rule of law, and it can't be rebutted, except in very narrow circumstances, which we may come on to. And the government would say that this is also, you've got to read this alongside the treaty, as I've said. So to the extent there was any doubt about Rwanda being safe, that doubt is now to be resolved because of these commitments that Rwanda was given as to how people must be treated.
And the key difference from the government's point of view is they rely on the terms of the new treaty signed with Rwanda on the basis that the treaty guarantees, assuming of course that Rwanda complies with its commitments. Under the new treaty, Rwanda is saying that in no circumstances will anyone sent to Rwanda be sent to any other country other than the UK. So they either stay in Rwanda regardless of the outcome of their asylum application, or they are returned to the UK. And that provision in the treaty is specifically designed to address the Supreme Court's concern about Rwanda's record of refoulement, in other words, returning people to a country where they may face persecution.
Yeah, and just again to recap, that the basis on which the Supreme Court said that Rwanda was unsafe was because of that very risk, that people would be sent on, would be refouled in the jargon, to other places where they might be mistreated. And the idea is the treaty will now prevent that.
Interestingly, although the Act, as you've said, allows challenge to being sent to Rwanda under very specific circumstances, and those are broadly that if you can show there is some circumstance specific to you that makes it dangerous for you to be in Rwanda, and it has to be very serious danger, you can avoid being sent there. But you cannot, as part of that argument, raise the risk of refoulement. You're barred from doing that. And it's quite interesting, that provision, because it seems to be there on the basis, I would assume, on the basis that the government couldn't trust the courts not to come to a conclusion adverse to the government about refoulement, given the history of Rwanda's behaviour in this area in the past.
Well, the Act doesn't allow, as you say, it doesn't allow the court to consider that question at all. So the commitment that Rwanda has given that people will not be refouled is now to be treated as completely binding and irrebuttable. And again, going back to the Supreme Court judgment, you recall that there's some history. Rwanda had entered into a treaty with Israel,
yeah,
which it was said not to have complied with, and that people were continued to be refouled despite the terms of that treaty. So all that doubt was what led to the adverse Supreme Court judgment. And the idea is that the government is now just declaring that no longer to be an issue, and the courts can't inquire into it.
What's interesting about that, and arguably makes the whole deeming provision all the more controversial, is that it's one thing to say the facts have changed in terms of Rwanda's ability to process claims effectively and so on. It's another thing to say that the credibility of Rwanda's diplomatic assurances has also completely changed, which was a key basis of the Supreme Court decision. Do you agree?
Yeah, well, at the moment, the treaty is really just a set of words on a page.
Yeah.
The House of Lords, Ken, you mentioned the ping-pong process between the Lords and Commons. One of the things the House of Lords wanted to do was to make the Act conditional on a report from the Independent Monitoring Committee. So the treaty sets up an independent committee whose job it is to monitor whether the commitments in the treaty have been in fact complied with. But all of that is still obviously just being set up. And the House of Lords said, well, this Act shouldn't come into effect until the Independent Monitoring Committee have certified that the procedures in the treaty have been set up in practice. But the government wasn't prepared to accept that. So although the committee will at some point report, that's not a condition of the of the Act coming into operation.
I was going to come on to that before you mentioned it, because we got to the situation in the Lords last Monday where there were two amendments really surviving being sent back to the Commons. One was the amendment from Des Brown, Lord Brown, the former Defence Secretary under the last Labour government, who wanted to introduce a clause which would prevent the government from sending to Rwanda any Afghan who came on a small boat who'd worked with British services, the British military forces in Afghanistan during our period of activity there. And the government gave a sort of concession on that. They didn't allow a clause, but they said on the record that they would not send someone to Rwanda who was an Afghan citizen who'd come on a small boat and who could be shown to have worked with the British forces in Afghanistan. So that was a concession. But the other amendment was David Hope's amendment, the former Deputy President of the Supreme Court, pressed by Lord Anderson of Ipswich on Monday night, which was the one that you've just mentioned, because David was making the point that Rwanda is plainly not safe at the moment. This treaty is not in force. There's been no recognition from anyone that Rwanda is safe at the moment. And yet this Act has passed, and the government wouldn't have his amendment, which would make the starting of deportations contingent upon a finding by this independent committee that Rwanda was now safe. And you say rather interestingly in your Institute of Government notes referring to this, as Lord Anderson has put it, the Act, quote, declares Rwanda to be safe, which it isn't yet, and will always be safe, which is obviously unknowable, unquote. And you say this, and I think this puts it as well as it has been put in any debate so far, in truth, what the Act is doing is making it lawful to send people to Rwanda, whether it is safe or not. Now, in your words, that's the nub of it, isn't it?
It is the nub of it. So we don't at the moment have any report from the Independent Monitoring Committee or anybody else that Rwanda is currently safe. We only have the commitments and statements of the two governments. And secondly, as Lord Anderson and others have said, the Act purports to say that for all time into the future, Rwanda is safe, whatever may happen there. So we may have future reports from the Independent Committee that says actually things are not going well and these commitments are not being complied with and people are being bundled onto planes. You know, who knows? But that will make no difference as the Act stands. The Act will still say that Rwanda is to be treated as safe even in the face of really terrible facts like that. Yeah. And the government wasn't, again, prepared to accept any kind of condition about if the Independent Monitoring Committee at some future point reports that, yeah, that circumstances have got worse. Well, that will make no difference to the legal presumption in the Act.
Can we just go back to this deeming provision and let me put to you what Lord Sumptions said in evidence to the Joint Committee in January of this year. They were reviewing the compatibility of the legislation, or the proposed legislation at that stage, with the Human Rights Convention, the Refugee Convention and so on. And what Lord Sumptions said was this. He said it's not uncommon for statutes to deem things that may or may not be correct. It's usually intended to cut out forensic argument about disputable questions, and the courts give effect to them according to their terms. And then he referred to a Supreme Court decision in the context of a taxing act. And he said, what is unusual is to use a deeming provision in a case as controversial as this one, and to include a deeming provision that effectively forecloses the whole argument in a high proportion of cases. And he said, in his view, the bill would be incompatible with Article 6 of the Convention as well as Article 13. Now, one of the things you flag up in your Institute for Government note is the possibility of what you call a constitutional challenge, which effectively would be asking the court to strike down an Act of Parliament. Now, we know the last time this issue came before the Supreme Court was in the Privacy International case, and that divided, the majority divided within itself on this issue, and so did the minority. So it's a fairly sort of unclear overall outcome. But I think your view, and I agree with you, is that the prospect of our courts striking down an Act of Parliament, expressed in the clear terms that this Act is, in terms of ousting the role of the court, that's not going to happen.
I think it's unlikely. I think the courts, including the present Supreme Court, will strain to give effect to this Act. Controversial though it obviously is, it is now law. I mean, the presumption is when Parliament passes an Act, it becomes the law. And it's the job of the courts to give effect to that law. So I think we just have to assume that's what the courts will try and do. The action will be around the provisions that do allow challenges, albeit on very narrow bases. We can expect challenges of that sort based on people's individual circumstances.
That's Section 4 of the Act.
That's Section 4. We can expect applications for declaration that the Act is incompatible with the European Convention on Human Rights. That is allowed. So we will see forms of legal action, and the courts will get drawn into this. But my assumption is that the courts will not want to be seen to disapply or overrule parts of the Act. The only question around that, as I said, is what happens if the facts in Rwanda become so notoriously bad? Let's hope they don't. You know, I'm not making any assumption. But the point about this Act is that it purports to declare Rwanda is safe, even if really terrible things are happening and there's a regime change and so on. What are the UK courts to do in those circumstances? And the Act says they're not even to consider evidence of that sort. And you can just see circumstances where a court say, in the face of that kind of evidence, we have to find a way of considering it. The Parliament can't have intended this to apply even in the face of notoriously appalling facts. But I think that's, you know, that is speculation, and I think the courts will want to avoid that situation if they can.
I think you're absolutely right about this. I think it's almost unthinkable that the courts would come to the conclusion that the whole Act or the central parts of it have to be struck down, and that would precipitate an enormous crisis between the courts and the government, and a massive political crisis. I don't think that's going to happen. If the sort of situation that you've described, for example, another genocide in Rwanda, murders of people who have been sent there by rampaging mobs or whatever, I mean, I think that would create a new situation. I guess, I mean, what was said in the Lords by ministers when this sort of argument was raised, well, of course, in that sort of situation, we wouldn't send people back to Rwanda. And I think it's quite unlikely, actually, that a government would. I mean, some people in the rights organisation say, well, you can never be sure. And of course, you can't be 100% sure. But I would think it's vanishingly unlikely, if refugees were being murdered in Rwanda, that any government of ours would send people there. So that situation would probably be resolved politically.
I think that must be right. You hope it's right, that if Rwanda became palpably unsafe, the government would at least pause the policy, if not repeal the Act. And of course, this will partly depend on who's the government at the time.
Jonathan, you just referred to the possibility of making a declaration of incompatibility under the Human Rights Act, that's Section 4 of the Human Rights Act. What's interesting, and I just want to ask you whether you can think why this is the case, almost all of the provisions of the Human Rights Act are displaced, they are disapplied under this Act, so that you can't, this is the whole problem with the Act, it's why the Joint Committee said it's incompatible with human rights and why Cleverly, James Cleverly, couldn't make a declaration that the bill was compatible. But they've allowed the one provision to go to remain in force, which is the ability to go to the court and say this is incompatible, what the court is being asked to do is incompatible with human rights principles. Why do you think they've maintained that possible route of challenge? Is it just a window dressing?
Well, I suspect there will have been some pretty anxious negotiation within government about the terms of this Act, I assume. And there, we know from the debates that there are some who think it doesn't go far enough, Suella Bravmans and so on. But there will certainly be some, both in government and in the Tory party, who thinks this is right at the limit of what is appropriate for the government in terms of the rule of law and access to the courts. And one can only just guess that there might be some, including the Attorney General, yeah, Victoria Prentice, who felt that there had to be some kind of safety valve. And Section 4 of the Human Rights is a kind of safety valve because it at least allows the question of compatibility with the European Convention to be tested in the courts. All you get, if you're successful, is a declaration.
Yeah.
So that doesn't force the government to do anything legally. And that may be part of the calculation that was made, that this was a painless concession to make for the government. It would allow the courts to assess the compatibility, but it wouldn't ultimately allow the courts to do anything actually to overturn the policy. So that may have been the calculation.
Or to stop planes taking
off.
Or
actually to stop anything. So yeah, that may have been the calculation.
Can we just look in a little more detail at challenges which will be possible, remain possible under the Act, including to Strasbourg? Because supporters of the legislation say that those who are opposed to it are over-egging this. And actually there are perfectly respectable routes for challenge if you can show that you as an individual would be unduly, grievously, egregiously harmed by being sent to Rwanda, and that should be the appropriate test. In other words, you can't challenge your removal to Rwanda on the grounds that the Republic of Rwanda is not a safe country in general, but you can challenge your removal on the grounds that there is evidence relating specifically to you and your individual circumstances which make it unsafe for you to be sent there. So what's wrong with that as a route to challenge this legislation? In other words, no high-flown challenges about Rwanda in general, but certainly specific challenges that you as an individual would be unsafe will be tolerated.
Well, I think we will undoubtedly see claims of that sort, and we'll have to see what the courts make of them. As we said earlier, that doesn't allow anybody to argue that there's a risk that they will be refooled onto a third country.
Yeah.
So that ground is completely excluded. So people will have to show there's something about their own particular circumstances, their health, their mental or physical health, or their background, or whatever it might be.
Or their sexuality, for example.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, the specific test is you can challenge on the basis that Rwanda is not a safe country for the person in question, based on compelling evidence relating specifically to the person's particular individual circumstances, rather than on the grounds that the Republic of Rwanda is not a safe country in general.
But the point I'm making is that the point that's made by supporters of the bill is, why isn't that enough? I mean, reform, I accept, is a separate issue, but the government says it will have a treaty with Rwanda. I know the Rwandans didn't follow the Israeli treaty, but why isn't it enough to allow people to challenge threats to their own individual circumstances rather than allowing these broader challenges? Why is it not enough?
We'll have to see. It may be enough for some people. As I say, I'm sure we will see challenges of that sort. The test is obviously deliberately set to be as high as the government thought it could get away with. It's reference to compelling evidence and so on. And the grounds for getting an interim injunction, which is what people will really want, if they seriously think they're going to be badly mistreated if they're sent to Rwanda, they will want to get an interim injunction stopping them to be sent. And the test for that is very narrow. That's that the person would face a real imminent and foreseeable risk of serious and irreversible harm. So these tests are deliberately set to be narrow. But as I say, I'm sure that there will be applications of that sort. And who knows what will happen.
Yeah, what's interesting, of course, is that in the wake of the Supreme Court decision and the domestic outrage, or at least within on the right of the Tory party, over the interim measure granted by Strasbourg, a single judge sort of in the middle of the night, grants the interim measure which stopped the planes taking off the first time. But of course, as of the beginning of this month, the Strasbourg court has replaced or altered the Rule 39 provision to make it much stricter in terms of, I'll just read the wording. Now the wording says the court may, in exceptional circumstances, whether at the request of a party or any other person concerned or of its own motion, indicate to the parties any interim measure which it considers should be adopted, such measures applicable in cases of imminent risk of irreparable harm.
Very familiar words, Tim. Very familiar. Familiar from
exactly,
the Rwanda.
Yeah. Which, on account of its nature, would not be susceptible to reparation, restoration, or adequate compensation, may be adopted where necessary in the interest of the parties, and so on. And now, although a single judge can grant interim relief sort of in the middle of the night, they then must refer it to a panel of judges, and the identity of the judges is revealed. So Strasbourg has changed its approach to interim measures, no doubt, politically, to deal with the sort of the fear that the UK is going to continue to, or the Tory party would continue to want to leave the convention. And now the wording of interim measures are reflected in the domestic legislation.
Notwithstanding that, of course, the Rwanda bill leaves to ministers the decision as to whether or not they wish to comply with these interim measures. And I assume that in most circumstances that one can imagine, ministers will decide not to.
Well, so this is really the last possible route of challenge, that if somebody wants to prevent their removal and they go through the process we've described in the UK courts, and the UK courts say, no, we're not satisfied that there's a sufficiently serious risk, then the individual goes off to Strasbourg under the ECHR and seeks the similar kind of interim measure, the Rule 39 measure. And again, as Tim has said, the test is very high. This will all depend on the evidence. The Strasbourg court will not be bound by the presumption in the bill about Rwanda being safe.
No, that's important.
So the Strasbourg court will have to make its own judgment as to what the risk is based on the evidence, and it will all depend on the evidence. But again, you know, there is a risk here of a kind of clash, because if Strasbourg does order the temporary halting of a removal, then, as Tim has said, the Act says that the ministers can decide whether or not to comply with that order. There'll be a massive political controversy if they do delay, and there'll be a clash with Strasbourg if they don't. So, you know, all of this still remains to be played out.
Well, this is a very serious risk under the present government. I think Rishi Sunak has rather implied, and he hasn't stated boldly, he may have stated boldly, that if Strasbourg rules against the government on this, he will, as a last resort, leave the Strasbourg court, which is a pretty serious threat to raise, and maybe a threat which is repeated during a general election campaign later this year. I mean, that would be a serious political crisis for him, because it sounds as though substantial numbers of his cabinet would resign in those circumstances.
Well, again, I don't want to sort of over-personalise it to the Attorney General, but she is quite an important constitutional player in this. I think she would be placed in difficulty if the government were minded to ignore a Rule 39 measure. And I certainly think she would have difficulty if the government were to commit to leaving the ECHR and she wouldn't be on her own.
I think Alex Chalk would also be in a difficult position. I mean, he's on a knife edge in his constituency, which is a reasonably liberal constituency, and he has his own principles, which I do not think encompass leaving the European court.
And Victoria Prentice, as you said, she's in the tradition of Dominic Grieve as Attorney General rather than Suella Braverman.
I'd have thought so.
So, I mean, just to sum up where we are, as far as you're concerned, there will be domestic challenges brought by individuals trying to rely on the Section 4 provision, which is requires compelling evidence that you, as a result of going to Rwanda, will suffer harm that you wouldn't suffer if you stayed here. I mean, that's the first criteria, or the first category. There may well be a constitutional challenge, in other words, a full-on attempt to say this act is completely contrary to separation of powers principles, it's contrary to the rule of law, therefore the court should strike down effectively the Act of Parliament. You don't think that will succeed if it's brought?
I don't. I say unless at some future point the evidence became really compelling, in which case you might think the whole policy would be abandoned anyway. So I think that's all speculative.
There will be an application for declaration of incompatibility, which will almost certainly be granted, because everyone accepts, including the Secretary of State in introducing it, that it's not compatible. So that will happen. Interim relief, I think your view is, very high bar, both domestically and in Strasbourg, to get interim relief.
But that all depends on the evidence, and none of us can really know, you know, what a particular individual might be able to show about their circumstances and the risk to them.
Yeah.
And that's where the courts do come in, to assess that kind of evidence.
Of course, these are all reasons why the Tory right felt that this legislation was full of holes, precisely because it will allow these sorts of challenges, and they foresee the government getting tied up in knots again in court. And I don't think that's a ludicrous fear, frankly. I think there could be quite a lot of litigation around this, which could be very irritating for the government and politically awkward. Can I just ask whether any of us have any sympathy with the government's predicament? And we have a situation where we are signed up to a number of treaties, many of which were drafted in the late 1940s, early 1950s, in the aftermath of a dreadful world war. And tests like a well-founded fear of persecution might have seemed appropriate then. I mean, in today's world, that test could apply to tens, perhaps hundreds of millions of people, certainly tens of millions of people, all of whom, if they could establish it, would have a right of asylum in a variety of Western countries. So there is, and people always mention climate change in this context, and, you know, massive movements of populations and so on. In this situation, isn't it inevitable that some Western countries, and perhaps in the end all Western countries, will be seeking to devise means to stop these sorts of population transfers, even if the means they devise could be seen in some circumstances as being incompatible with some of those treaties? Isn't this just an aspect of real politic and of the world in which we find ourselves?
Well, thank you for that as a last question. And how do we redesign the whole global system for managing migration?
Come on, Jonathan. Quick answer.
So I have some sympathy for that very complex geopolitical problem. I think I have little or no sympathy with the government for this solution, which is deliberately excluding courts from considering real evidence of people's individual human rights might be breached. And whether the test is right or not, as you say, there might be scope for revisiting some of those international law tests. But the solution simply of deeming for all purposes and closing off all argument about whether we're not here talking about some technical tax measure. We're talking about the risk that individual human beings might be seriously ill-treated. Now, that may or may not be a real risk, but the point is the solution the government has adopted is one that is designed almost completely to prevent that risk from being tested and assessed. And that, I think, that's the real problem with this.
I mean, the other point is this. Ken's argument, which no doubt many people would accept, that it's desirable at the international level for countries to address this problem, to the extent it's been identified as a problem, in a collective global way. That's one thing. But as you say, doing it this way, A, it's highly unlikely to be effective, it's incredibly expensive, it's contrary to the rule of law. And the other thing is that the one possibility that the UK had to address this problem collectively was by remaining in the EU. And we've left the EU, and this problem has directly arisen. I mean, before, people were being returned to France.
Yeah, well, we are where we are. I mean, it's not my argument. I'm just posing this as an interesting point for discussion, because I do sometimes feel, I mean, I've often, when we've taken evidence from people in various meetings in the Lords and from various rights organisations, I always ask them, you know, what's your solution? And people talk about speed. There isn't really anything sensible put forward. I mean, I don't think Keir Starmer's proposal to, you know, process things better is all very well, but I don't think that's going to solve the problem of mass movements of population over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, I'm just saying, I think this is a serious political problem for governments, and it's partly fueling the rise of the populist right, and it's very difficult, and I don't think we can pretend it's not happening. I know the three of us aren't, but I just think sometimes we ought to be alive to the very, very real political problems that this is creating for governments in developed countries.
But, I mean, whether, leave aside all our concerns about the rule of law and the role of the courts and so on, whether this act in practice and the threat of sending a relatively small number of people to Rwanda will actually make any difference to it.
No, I don't think it will. I don't think it'll work. I mean, that's one of the that's an equally forceful argument against. I just don't think it will work.
Well, we await developments, as they say, and I think probably what lies underneath all of this is probably no one thinks that the Tories are going to be in power in 6 months' time anyway, and this whole policy is going to be either repealed in terms of the Act of Parliament or the policy abandoned. Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us for this special edition to focus on the Act.
Pleasure.
And no doubt we'll have you back again for a fourth, fifth, or even sixth occasion. Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us, Jonathan. It's been a pleasure as ever.
You've been listening to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with Ken MacDonald and with me, Tim Owen. If you've enjoyed this episode, have a look at our back catalogue and you will find lots of other interesting episodes, many of which are not time sensitive. And if you've really, really enjoyed this one, why not give us a good review? We are highly rated on both Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and we will be back in touch with you very soon.